Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, there's good news for the Obama administration on the Iran nuclear deal. We'll hear about the role of human traffickers in the migrant exodus for Europe. Let's take a closer look at the Pope's mercy for abortion users.
You hear and see and feel the heart of a pastor who's very much in touch with people's suffering.
And from our music library, country singers Matty Marlowe and Tay Dye have their first CD. It's ahead on The Voice of America. Champagne corks might be popping down at the White House. After a long-fought battle for congressional support, it appears the Iran nuclear deal may be getting the backing it needs. U.S. Senator Barbara Mikulski, a Democrat, is the 34th member of the Senate to commit to supporting the pact. That is enough to get the agreement through Congress. The lawmakers said no deal is perfect, but this is the best option to block Tehran from getting the bomb. Iran insists its nuclear endeavors are for peaceful purposes only. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry today took his argument for the nuclear agreement to the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
2 months ago, in Vienna, the United States and five other nations, including permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, reached agreement with Iran on ensuring the peaceful nature of that country's nuclear program. As early as next week, Congress will begin voting on whether to support that plan. And the outcome will matter as much as any foreign policy decision in recent history. President Obama and I are convinced beyond any reasonable doubt that the framework that we have put forward will get the job done. And in that assessment, we have excellent company. Last month, 29 of our nation's top nuclear physicists and Nobel Prize winners, scientists, from one end of the country to the other, congratulated the president for what they called, quote, a technically sound, stringent, and innovative deal that will provide the necessary assurance that Iran is not developing nuclear weapons. The scientists praised the agreement for its creative approach to verification and for the rigorous safeguards that will prevent Iran from obtaining the fissile material for a bomb.
For reaction to today's developments, we went to Omri Sarin with the Israel Project, and he's joining us now on the line. First of all, can you tell us what your reaction is?
Well, you know, this is a legislative fight and a policy fight, which is to say, you know, here in Washington, D.C., we divide politics and policy that'll continue. The development today is that the president managed to lock in one-third of the Senate to support a deal that most of them have publicly described as troubling, and a bipartisan, it doesn't change the math that we already knew, which is that a bipartisan majority in both the Senate and the House are already on the record rejecting this deal, which is why it's a little weird to hear it being described publicly, and this is, of course, happening on Twitter and the newspapers right now, as, you know, winning over Congress. It's not that. It's being able to override a congressional veto.
And why are you so opposed to this nuclear agreement?
Well, there's a range of reasons why the agreement is bad for America. The two overarching ones is that it forces us to sponsor the Iranian nuclear program for the next 10 to 15 years. And the second is that it disables us from opposing Iran conventionally. As Iran marches across the region, destabilizes our allies, attacks our allies, funds terrorism. You know, that first thing, Susan, is about sponsoring their nuclear program. There's an annex to the JCPOA, the Final Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that Annex 3 specifically, that calls on the parties to engage in nuclear cooperation with Iran. In fact, it's titled Nuclear Cooperation. And it obligates, there's a section that obligates the parties to assist Iran in preventing nuclear sabotage. Secretary Kerry was asked by Congress, hey, does this obligate us if the Israelis decide to cyber attack Iranian nuclear facilities? Does this obligate us to side with Iran against our Israeli allies? And the secretary's response was, don't worry, it'll never come to that. Well, a lot of people are very afraid that it'll come to that, in addition to the fact that our negotiators caved on a range of transparency measures and, in fact, prerequisites to transparency. These go under the banner of the so-called possible military dimensions of Iran's program. We're not forcing the Iranians to come clean. We don't know what they have. We can't guarantee that they've given it up. And even if we could catch them, we'd be disabled from calling their bluff because we'd become too invested in this bad deal by then.
Well, thank you very much, Amri, for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Even though it now appears the Iran nuclear deal will survive a congressional challenge, the debate about the agreement is as intense as ever on social media. Michael Lippin has joined us here in the studio for more on that. Michael, what's going down?
Hi, Susan. Well, the Obama administration has been very active on Twitter today to promote the Iran nuclear deal through a special Twitter account that it set up earlier this year. That handle is @TheIranDeal, and it's got almost 27,000 followers. One of its latest tweets tries to refute the argument of critics who point out that some of the deal's restrictions on Iranian nuclear activity will expire in 15 years, potentially enabling Iran to race to a nuclear bomb at that time. Well, the Iran deal Twitter account responded to that argument with a rhetorical question. If your house is on fire, would you refuse to put it out because there could be another fire in 15 years? And by that, the White House is making the point that the house, a reference to the Middle East, is already on fire, and the deal is an effort to put out that fire now. Well, the Iran deal Twitter account also tweeted a series of quotes from U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's speech earlier today, as you mentioned at the start of the show. It quoted Kerry as saying, "Under safeguards of the U.N. nuclear agency, Iran is prohibited from ever pursuing a nuclear weapon." And then it added a note saying, "That's permanent."
Well, what have the key critics of the deal been saying?
Well, one of those critics is the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whose handle is @IsraeliPM. The pinned tweet on that account has this message: The Iran deal leaves Iran with the nuclear infrastructure to produce an entire arsenal of atomic bombs. And that tweet also shows a picture of a gun whose chamber is loaded with bullets that have nuclear icons on them. And the message next to that picture says, "Don't play Iranian roulette with the world's security." Susan?
Well, thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
How would you like to spend the next 60 days in bed? That's what the European Space Agency is asking 12 men to do, all in the name of science. The first members of this group of a dozen will hit the sack for 2 months, starting September 9th. The bed-in, according to ESA, is a part of the research they're conducting so that they can learn how to stop the wasting effects of spaceflight on the body. Although the experiment may sound like a cozy and relaxing time for the volunteers, ESA says that it will not be as a restful experience as it sounds. This isn't the first bed rest study arranged by the ESA. The space agency held others that were of various lengths and included both men and women. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
For the second day, Hungary continued to deny migrants and refugees permission to board trains at Budapest for transit to Austria, then Germany. Reports say at least 2,000 people were stranded at Budapest train station. Meanwhile, the flow of boats continued to leave the Libyan coast for Italy, or if not, at least rescue in the Mediterranean by the Italian Coast Guard, which puts these migrants within the European Union. International Edition's Jeffrey Young continues to focus on the situation and has new details on what is behind the boat situation in Libya. Hi, Jeffrey, and welcome.
Hi, Susan. I spoke about the Libyan boat situation with Peter Roberts, a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London. He says human traffickers are the ones behind the boats full of refugees leaving Libya.
There are boats leaving daily, several a day, that are moving both from Libya and from Syria across into Greece and Italy, carrying thousands of people every day across to the mainland of Europe.
Well, somebody has to operate these boats. Are these human traffickers that are chartering boats? What can you tell me about the mechanism of this transport?
What it appears to be is a series of human trafficking organizations and groups, some of them ad hoc, some of them organized and into organized crime, who have leaped upon this business opportunity to strip migrants of their money before they get into Europe. They're charging up to $20,000 to get across the piece of the Mediterranean into mainland Europe, and they are getting the migrants, often without life jackets or any supplies of food and water, into old fishing boats, old naval boats, or even just inflatable dinghies that you can buy at a supermarket, and then send them across, sometimes with a captain, sometimes without. The lucky ones will have an outboard engine with sufficient fuel to get them across the mainland. But often, this is not a prerequisite for taking money from people and sending them off. They will arrive on a beach not knowing what type of vessel they're getting into. They'll get pushed into one vessel and sent on their way, and normally that's about as far as the trafficking organizations will take them, and they disown responsibility from then on. Some of the boats do contain captains. Normally, just like piracy, this is where fishing no longer provides enough financial incentive for people, and the captains and the crews will then be paid by the human traffickers to try and get these people across to Europe. And they'll sail a straight path across to Europe, hoping that their boat doesn't break down on the way there, and perhaps that they will make it to shore on the Italian side.
From the Libyan coast to Sicily, what is the transit time on average? I realize that, you know, boats have different speeds, but just give me an idea as to how long people would be out in the open water between Libya and Sicily.
Well, you know, it's as difficult to calculate that as it is to calculate how long it would take to get from Cuba to Florida, because it appears that lots of these boats that we're seeing either don't have the fuel to make the trip, or where they do make the trip can only make 5 or 6 knots. They could be at sea for 24 hours. Some of them have been at sea for 10 days when they've been picked up. There really is no mean standard time for getting across, and nor do the human traffickers sell their passage on this of these trips to people based on any particular time to get across. It's just on the hope of delivery.
That was Royal United Services Institute Senior Research Fellow Peter Roberts.
It's very sad. People are so desperate that they'll literally risk their lives to reach Europe.
I'll continue to follow this, Susan.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, a change of policy by the Vatican, and a country music duo climbing the charts. The Vatican has published a letter in which Pope Francis announced women seeking forgiveness for abortions can do so through their local priests during the Roman Catholic Church's Year of Mercy, beginning December 8th and running through November 20th, 2016. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins me now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, in his statement issued Tuesday, the Pope said, "I have decided to concede to all priests for the Jubilee year the discretion to absolve of the sin of abortion those who have procured it and who with contrite heart seek forgiveness. Bishops are already able to authorize priests in their diocese to forgive those who undergo or carry out abortions." The Pope made clear that he isn't downplaying the gravity of abortion. He said the tragedy of abortion is experienced by some with a superficial awareness, as if not realizing the extreme harm that such an act entails. Many others, on the other hand, he says, although experiencing this moment as defeat, believe they have no other option. The Reverend Thomas Rosica, Chief Executive Officer of the Catholic Media Foundation in Toronto, Canada, told me the statement is in line with the Pope's vision of a merciful church and comes out of a life of ministry in his native Argentina.
It's a great jubilee, extraordinary jubilee of mercy. And if we go back and recall what Pope John Paul II did in the year 2000 and leading up to the Great Jubilee, he also spoke very much about this. In fact, John Paul did it about 5 years before the year 2000 in a very famous document now called Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life. It was an encyclical in which John Paul also spoke about women who had had abortions and how important the gift of mercy and forgiveness is. The uniqueness about Pope Francis's message and the letter he wrote to Archbishop Fisichella is you hear and see and feel the heart of a pastor who's very much in touch with people's suffering. And he refers specifically to the cases that he himself dealt with and, the, you know, listening to women's stories. He's been a pastor in Argentina for many years. He knows pain and suffering. He knows the difficulties that women have had. No one wins in an abortion situation. The Pope knows that. He's also very much aware of the legality of abortion in the United States. He's coming to this country very shortly. And he's offering a message of mercy and telling people, nobody is forgotten, nobody's on the fringes. Don't exclude yourself from God's circle of mercy. Come and seek the mercy from the church. Seek forgiveness. And what the Pope is doing is telling priests, in this year, this special Jubilee year, which begins on December the 8th, when someone comes to you, forgive them, and they're really repentant, offer them the gift of forgiveness for their abortion. This does not mean that priests couldn't do that beforehand, but there's a special situation when this takes place in a Jubilee year. And this year that's coming up from December the 8th to the following Christ the King Sunday is a special year. And there's special, we believe there's special graces and blessings that are given to people during that year.
Well, this year of mercy ends November 20th, 2016, according to AP. What happens on November 21st of that year?
That's a very good question. Well, first of all, rather than looking at this as, you know, get it all in now, because after November 20th, there won't be mercy, one can only imagine that the trajectory that the Pope has placed the Church on is a real movement of mercy and of forgiveness, but it's not at all cheap mercy and cheap forgiveness. It's a call to awareness that sin has great effects. Sin alienates us from God and from others. And the Pope is saying, let's use this year, and see what happens to the Church and to the world and to people in the world. And let's look at this period first. Let's not worry about what happens after November 20th, 1 year from now. Let's seize this momentum in this moment.
The letter was issued ahead of the Pope's visit to the United States, which begins September 19th and runs through the 27th. Rosica says the letter was issued not because of the pending U.S. visit, but ahead of the Year of Mercy.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A new aspartame-free version of Diet Pepsi has arrived on supermarket shelves. Pepsi has replaced aspartame in the popular soda drink with sucralose, the same non-nutritive sweetener found in Splenda. There are many options when it comes to artificial sweeteners. Sweet'n'Low, or granulated saccharin, was first introduced in 1957. More recently, plant-based sweeteners such as stevia and truvia have gained favor. People like Christine Arundel turned to sugar substitutes to avoid calories.
It is a personal choice of not drinking my calories, but rather wanting to eat them instead of putting them in my drink.
But do sugar substitutes help you lose weight? Dr. Mark Hyman with the Cleveland Clinic.
When you consume artificial sweeteners, they trick your body to think sugar's on the way, and that gears your body up to store the food, and it creates insulin that leads to fat storage.
I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Country singers Matty Marlow and Tay Diggs burst onto the scene last year with a song that poked fun at the male-dominated lyrics on country radio. Now their first CD, Start Here, is out, and their second single is climbing the country airplay charts. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about Matty and Tay and their rise to stardom.
You might not know what bro country is, but Matty and Tay do, and their first single that went to number one was all about bro country. Nikki, explain to the listeners, first of all, what bro country is and why the song The Girl in a Country Song was such a big hit.
Well, bro country is male-dominated country music where men are centered, and it's all about the guys and what the guys do, what makes the guys bond. It's male-centered country music.
And, you know, it's women tend to be more ornamental to the men in the character.
Yes,
so
yes,
Matty and Tay got a little tired of that.
They did. They did. What was really hilarious is that they were going to a recording session, and they were listening to country radio, and they started making a checklist. They realized the lyrics were similar, and they were like, wait a second. They found that there were a lot of cliches, so they wrote them down. They were like, okay, bare feet, cutoffs, tan lines, tan legs, and definitely a girl. And this smoking hot girl is usually in cutoff jeans with long tan legs, and she's dancing on a tailgate, shaking her moneymaker. And they were like, wow.
Moneymaker being a name for her
derriere.
Yes. Rear end.
Exactly. And they thought it would be fun to give this girl a voice in a song. And that's where Girl in a Country Song came into play.
And it went to number one in December of last year.
That's
surprise,
right.
Surprise. And some of the guys, Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan and Blake Shelton and Florida Georgia Line and all these other guys that had been making bro country had to kind of answer to that.
Yes. You know, what's interesting is that Florida Georgia Line, I think it was Bryan, who said, I don't know any girl who wouldn't want to be a girl in a country song. Which I thought spoke a lot to the disconnect, the dehumanization of the woman and of the girl. And so I thought it was interesting that his response was very much like, oh.
And see, now, that was so popular, and you're only as good as your last record.
Yes.
And so Maddie and Tay had to come up with a second single.
Yes, yes.
Which Tay Dye, that's her full name, has said, you know, we were trying to write this thing that would be like a girl in country song as part
the pressure,
two.
Right, the pressure.
And they ended up coming up with a very different sounding tune called Fly.
Yes, about really, which is about perseverance through adversity. And I think when they talked about trying to write another hit and that pressure of following up, and they just threw it out and said, you know what, let's just be honest and let's write something from our hearts and let's write something that's true to us. And that's how Fly came about as well.
All right. Well, you know, if you want to send a tweet to Nikki, you can send one to @VOA_music. You can also listen for Nikki when she hosts Country Hits USA. You can find that on our website, www.voanews.com.
Thanks for joining us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Modern slavery is a blight on humanity and is nearly universally condemned, but it does not exist in a vacuum. Trafficking in persons is often perpetrated by well-organized transnational criminal gangs that ensure smooth operations through bribery. In the process, they destroy not only the lives of people whom they enslave, they degrade entire economies. Slavery doesn't just destroy communities and harm everyday people. It fuels a network of ruthless criminals and armed groups that create insecurity and instability around the world, said David Luna, a senior director in the Office of Anti-Crime Programs at the U.S. State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs. The societal harms and impacts posed by human trafficking are very real. Corruption helps to fuel it and enriches not only those criminal networks behind today's modern slavery, but also enables corrupt police, customs, judicial, and other security officials who protect traffickers and allow them to carry out their criminal activities. Modern slavery recognizes no borders, and therefore, just as no economy is immune from corruption, no single jurisdiction can solve this problem on its own. To defeat this scourge, the community of nations must begin by making clear to the public how much harm human trafficking causes to communities and educating vulnerable populations about the methods used to ensnare and exploit those they enslave. We must also increase the scrutiny of supply chains where little to none may exist. Governments must adopt the highest standards of accountability and human rights protection and ensure that their suppliers and contractors are held to those standards as well. At the same time, international organizations and companies must enforce policies against human trafficking throughout their supply chains. Mechanisms must be established to report cases of abuse, harassment, or violence, and to identify and protect victims of trafficking. Human trafficking siphons away the human capital potential of communities to build sustainable economic growth in a manner that respects human rights, said Mr. Luna. No person should ever have a price tag attached to their heart and soul, nor be restricted, abused, and violated against their physical integrity and free will.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.